morning I want to talk about something that stirs my heart, and it's one of my favorite things to actually talk about, and it's life transformation. It's change. And we've been in a series that we're calling Exiles, and we're taking a look at the story of Daniel during this series, and we'll be in Daniel chapter 3 today, but I want to preface it by this. When we think about change, and when we think about this day, I think God's always inviting us into new places. And if there's anybody that shouldn't be afraid of change, it's us. If there's anybody that shouldn't be afraid of something inside of us having to die so that something new could come to life, it would be us, because we actually belong to the resurrection. The one who said he is the resurrection, the one who died and rose again and gave birth to the greatest hope this world has ever known. And so today, as we think about change, I want to invite you to already begin to think about, is there an area in my life that God may be longing to just invite me into a new place, to just shower me with blessings, to bless me in a way that my life would get deeper and richer and maybe a little bit more like Jesus. And I want to take a look at a story that, if you've heard the story of these three guys, really weird names, but Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or their Hebrew names that are Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. If we were to look at these three characters today as a way of getting at change, and in particular, not so much zeroing in on their story as this other guy that's in the story. And his name is Nebuchadnezzar. All right, so let's zero in on Nebuchadnezzar and what happens to him as a result of God using Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to really challenge this guy's way of thinking. So it begins like this, chapter 3, verses 1 through 7. And it says, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. What we are talking about is a god that he had formed, and there's many descriptions of how that happened. Some have said that it was made out of wood and was overlaid with gold. Others said that it's made of pure gold. This is the second highest god figure that was made during that day that stood 90 feet high. Is how tall this thing was, 9 feet wide. So he set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And he summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials. These are the who's who in society. He is bringing in all those that are of standing, saying, I'm going to throw a party, or I'm going to hold a gathering. This is going to be the highest level of importance, that you all might show up for the dedication of this 90-foot gold god image. So all the other, if you could back up, please, all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before it. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "Nations and people of every language, this is what you are commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp and pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and all kinds of music, all the nations and peoples of every language fell down and worshiped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Now, this story, if you were here a couple weeks ago when we kicked this series off, this story actually was a story that was told by Tanner Smith in this way. He said that this story we're about to read was one of his son's favorite stories. And it's a really good story. In fact, there were two stories. It's a story, both of them coming out of the book of Daniel, the story of the den where Daniel was tossed into the den, and then this one, a furnace where Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we'll get there in a bit, were tossed into a furnace. And this story is incredible, like so many other stories that we love, because there's so much tension, there's so much drama in the story. When we think about stories that we love, it's often like your favorite movie or your favorite stories. It's often those stories that get you to the edge of your seat that you remember and you love. There's something about them. It's like the music begins to go, or it's an action movie, or a movie where the villain shows up, or a movie where there's drama and you're like, it's about to go down. It's about to happen. And you're on the edge of your seat because something is about to go down. Well, what makes this story so incredible is this. Is that even though the king ordered that everybody bow down to this statue, not everybody did. Not everybody chose to bow down. There were three in the story that as they stood among this assembly and all nations and the prefects and all these who's who's are gathered around, standing, and that moment comes where they were to bow down before this gold image, there are three that are still standing up. And those three actually had it spoken about them, these words right here. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up. King Nebuchadnezzar, you heard, we issued the decree that everybody should bow, and if they don't bow, they're actually going to lose their lives. We spoke that over the whole crowd, but we have three that neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold that you have set up. Like to the edge of your seat, what is about to go down? What's about to happen here? Why would they do that? The reason that they would refuse to actually bow down, it goes all the way back to their childhood. They didn't grow up in Babylon. They were dragged off into captivity. They were exiles in Babylon. These three grew up in a different place, and they grew up among the Jewish people, and they grew up knowing the Shema, that Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. And they did. And they also had this down, probably since the age of about 5. They would have memorized the Ten Commandments. And they knew what Exodus chapter 20 said when these words were written. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or in the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to worship to them or worship them. And they wouldn't. These weren't just words. This wasn't just some thing that they memorized as kids that got spoken enough that it ended up in their memory. These were words that found their way inside. It was who they were. And they were not going to bow down to some big, old, 90-foot gold god when they went, no way. We serve the one God. We're not bowing down to some false gods. Now, you can imagine, and I don't know if you've ever noticed this on somebody before, when they become really angry. But when you see somebody that becomes really, really angry, it's like the face can actually change. And this next scripture, it made me think about that. And the next part of the scripture reads this way. Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Like he had already laid out. If you don't bow down to this king, or this God, rather, if you don't bow down to this God, you will be put to death. And they dare defy his order. Bring those three to me. Now I wondered, like, what does his face look like in this moment? And so I looked it up on Google, because you can find like everything on Google, right? And I'm like, can I actually find a picture of Nebuchadnezzar? And the answer is yes, I found it. Here it is, right there. This is exactly what he looked like. And so Nebuchadnezzar, he's furious with rage. Back to the scripture. So furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar said to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now, when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. You got one more chance. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then, what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it. And he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. Like, what chance is there that these words are actually going to take the temperature down for the king? Like, no way, right? These words aren't going to help. Like, we don't need to defend ourselves before you, king. We're just letting you know that our God's going to deliver us from your hand. And you said what God could deliver you from? Well, actually, our God can deliver us from your hand. And he will. He's going to. Or if he doesn't, even if he doesn't, just letting you know that we're not going to bow down. We will not bow down and serve your gods. And what happens next is amazing. Because the king, he got so enraged at that moment. Have you ever heard of like somebody's losing their mind? Like when they get so mad, they're losing their mind. Have you ever been in that place where you got angry enough? I saw a couple of people looking at each other. This is fantastic. So have you ever been in a place like where you got so angry and you started speaking and you're like, I know this doesn't make any sense, but I'm just louder and I'm more angry. And it's like you can't even think straight and stuff's rolling out of your mouth. Well, this is kind of one of those scenarios, really. And what actually is happening at that point is you flip from the front of your brain, this frontal cortex where you actually do good thinking, and you slip to the back of your brain, and it's just full on. And so I actually believe that the text here would tell us that he slipped. He went into his lizard brain, and he is losing it. Like he has lost his mind, because what Nebuchadnezzar says is, stoke the fire 7 times hotter. I'm like, what are you talking about, man? Like, how... Nobody's going to argue with him at this point, but here's the truth. A fire in your backyard, like your fire pit, it's right around 800 degrees, and that's hot enough. But if you take a house fire, and in 3.5 minutes, a house can burn to the point where the temperature rises to 1,100 degrees. Give it a few more minutes, you can get up to 1,400 degrees. Back in the day of Nebuchadnezzar, when they made bricks, they would put them into a brick kiln. And the brick kiln, it could get up to maybe 1,000. I mean, he'd be pushing it to put that thing up to 1,500, 1,600 degrees. It'd be pushing it to get that hot. And many believe, scholars believe, that actually the fire that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Hananiah, Azariah, Mishael, the fire that they got tossed into, we're a bit ahead of ourselves in the story, but the fire that they got tossed into was actually that of a brick kiln. This is how hot it got. 7 times hotter, how do we do that? And there are other scholars, I actually prefer this story, I don't know if it's accurate. One of these is accurate. We don't know what kind of fire he was actually thrown into, but many actually believe that this furnace was the one that was made for the purpose of sculpting this god, which is incredible to think about. That they have this towering god that was made in that furnace, but somehow this god has no power over what goes on inside of the furnace, because we're about to see something amazing happen in the story. But think about it. To take this thing 7 times hotter, the technology of the day, not possible. To even get it 7 times hotter. He's just losing it. Stoke that thing 7 times hotter. And so, nobody argues. They get it as hot as they can go. It's the hottest of hot fires. And into it are thrown, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, they are tossed into this fire. It is so hot that the guys that throw these three into the fire actually die when they get that close to the fire. It takes them out. And then what happens next? I mean, it's got the king absolutely befuddled. His face actually goes from this to this right there. And that one, that's not actually a picture of him. That one's just an emoji, but the other one, I'm just letting you know. So he's befuddled, like, what am I seeing here? I don't have a framework from what I'm seeing. And I don't know, like, is his head spinning? But verse 24 says these words. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, weren't there three men we tied up and threw into the fire? They replied, certainly, your majesty. He said, look, I see four men walking around on the fire, unbound and unharmed. And the fourth looks like the son of the gods. Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God. Like, what? Servants of the Most High God. This is a big, big leap from where he came from. Servants of the Most High God, come out, come here. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisors crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair on their heads singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them, not even like they've been standing around a campfire. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than to serve or worship any god except their own. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other God can save in this way. If you could leave that up just a second, TJ. You know, just read that. It's like, okay, Nebuchadnezzar isn't all the way there yet. He's still issuing decrees of threat. Like, if you don't worship this God, you're cut into pieces. Your house is burned, turned into rubble. But that last statement, look at that last statement. Because there is no other God that can save in this way. Again, I said I want to zero in on Nebuchadnezzar today. What happened? Like, if we were to really break this down, what happened in this guy? What is going on inside of him? Because I think that statement that he just made, this statement, praise the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, for no other God can save in this way, is the most important thing about him at any time prior to or in that moment in his entire life. Why would I say that? It's because of what A.W. Tozer said when he said, what comes to mind when we think about God is the most important thing about us. What comes to your mind when you think about God is the most important thing about you. And in a matter of moments, there was a massive shift where he is like, let's bow down and worship this 90-foot God to go and time out. I don't even know who that God is. That God is a fake. But this God, this one is for real. Nobody saves like he saves. What happened? And I want to get at that. What happened in Nebuchadnezzar? I want to say this, that there was a great disruption that happened in his life at that moment. When he was looking into that furnace and saw, like, time out, man, I just watched my soldiers drop dead, just tossing them into the fire, and they're walking around, and they were bound when they were thrown in there, and now they're unbound, and they're in there walking around, and we threw three in, there's a fourth in. It looks like the son of the gods, it's an angel, or it is God. What is this that we're looking at? And what we know is that God was in the midst of the fire with them, whether it was an angel or God himself matters not, but God was in that fire with them, protecting them, and he was seeing the same thing. And it didn't fit what he previously believed to be true. He made it clear. What God could possibly save you from me if you choose not to bow down on the second chance I'm giving you? And they said, we know him. I think you're about to see. And he was seeing it. And it began to make this massive shift, because what he thought about the world, what he thought about God, what he thought about life itself, it was moving drastically and quickly for him. What happens when we change? How does that come about? And I would love to say that I actually think that change comes about because we sit in church together, and because we preach sermons, and because we craft a message, and because we... And I think it does happen that way sometimes. I really do. I think there are times where God moves in the service in such a way that our lives are set on a new course. But usually the really big changes in our life, don't they happen when we're just kind of strolling down life? We're just tooling through life in a normal way, and something really disruptive happens. Some kind of disruption hits us. Doesn't have to be a bad thing, but it could be. It could be traumatic for us. Maybe we did something that ended a relationship, or somebody else did something that ended this relationship with them. Or maybe we found ourselves just totally surprised, and all of a sudden everything's shifting. Like, I thought I was heading this way with my career, but apparently not. And now I have to think about where I'm going with my life. Or something really powerful happens. Like, we are climbing up this figurative mountain, and we find ourselves at the top, and at the top of the mountain, we experience God in ways like we've never experienced God before. Or peace in ways we've never experienced peace. Or joy like we've never had before. We knew in those moments, there's zero chance if I keep down the road that I'm on right now, because my worldview is getting blown up. What I thought to be true is being really challenged here. That if we lean into that, we have the sense that we're going to go on a journey. Chances are, I'm never coming back. This is a journey that's going to lead me from here to somewhere where I've never been before, and there's no coming back from this one. We have a choice to make. Are we going to take that journey? Or are we going to go, how do I now forget what I just saw? How do I forget what I just experienced? Or how do I ignore this because that journey looks too hard, like a choice to make? Are we going to change or not change? Are we going to step into that or not step into that? So when I think about the anatomy of change itself, I think it starts with this. It starts with a disruption. If we were to look at what is the anatomy of change, it starts with some kind of disruption. Like life, I'm just kind of going through it, and all of a sudden it gets disrupted. In a beautiful way or a traumatic way, a painful way or a really joy-filled way, whatever it might be. And check that with me a minute. Think back into your life. Think about a moment where you said, this thing changed me. That moment. Where were you? Can you still see it? Can you still smell the smells of that moment, that place? What was going on around you? What was happening inside of you? Where this disruption, whatever it was, traumatic or powerfully beautiful, you went, I'll never be the same again. This challenged what I thought to be, and I'm shifting in a different direction. There's some kind of disruption that happened. This morning, at the first service, this morning I woke up at super early, but then I, like for real, woke up at 4:30 this morning, and it felt like this time change got me all messed up. It's like, it's time to roll. Like, I was wide awake at 4:30 for two reasons. One is, just felt like time to get up. But the other reason is this, is because we had a baptism here this morning in the first service for a guy named Chance Boz. And Chance and I had a couple different conversations, but the real conversations, they happen somewhere else. And there's a whole row, and typically the second service here, that's up front here, that's full of True Value guys and their wives and their children and the families that are part of True Value. And Chance was employed, is employed over at True Value. And while he was at True Value, he just honestly said to me, I didn't think I'd be there that long. I was just looking for a short-time job. And this young man said I was just going to go on and make some cash and then probably move on to something else. But I found that something was happening. Like, man, I fit with this group. Like, I have my own family, and I'm starting to find a different sort of family. And they actually don't just care that I show up to work and do a good job. They actually care about me, and I'm sensing for the first time in my life, like, I really belong somewhere, and I belong to these people. And then a guy named RC led him across the line of faith, and an employee there at True Value. And then Chad and Ross and the True Value guys, Brett, and these guys just leaned into him. And so this morning, we're up here doing a baptism, and Chance had a True Value shirt on. He asked me if he could get baptized in a True Value shirt. Here's why. We were talking about what happened at True Value, where he was getting discipled and taught about Jesus by these guys. And I was like, man, you're describing something so cool here. It's like you just fit in with these guys, and they belong to you, and you belong to them. Like, they become family to you, and this is where you first learned about Jesus. And Chance about blew my eardrum on the phone. He's like, yeah, man, these guys, True Value is my first church. And I'm like, that is a cool statement, right? That his very first church was True Value. It's a True Value. There was this divine disruption that was happening. He was doing life, carrying a weight. He actually told me after service, it was so beautiful, down with these guys, he goes, I feel like this load of darkness is gone. It's just gone. And I feel lighter than I've ever been. And I just thought that's an amazing statement. But he was having this divine disruption, like, who are these guys? Why do they love me so much? How come for the first time in my life, I feel like I really belong somewhere? What is this? And in his exploration and questions, he ended up finding the one that had been seeking him. Because Jesus comes to seek and save that which is broken, is dark, is carrying loads. He comes to seek and save that which is lost. And he came into a relationship with Christ and became a part of our church this morning. Some sort of divine disruption, the anatomy of change. The second thing that I see happens is that you have to have some sort of preparation. If you're really going to change, the divine disruption, you could go, okay, this is really something I've never seen before, like King Nebuchadnezzar. Like, wow, this is like, what is going on here? He could have walked away. He was the king. He could have ignored it. He could have just stepped away from it. But instead, he stared into it and then wondered about it. Here's what I would suggest. If we're sensing God is leading us to a new place of change, when you begin to sense that, that is that divine disruption, that divine invitation. And the next step is to have some kind of preparation, to form a plan around it. Like, what is God asking me to do? You think about a verse that says, trust in the Lord with all your heart, lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your path straight. And so, what does it look like to acknowledge? And like, God, what would you have me to do next? And that may mean that part of your plan is to have a conversation with one or two trusted people. Like, what are my next steps? Because I sense God leading me to a new place of health, or a new place in our relationship, or a new whatever that might be. Like, God's taken me somewhere that I haven't been before. And I want to form a plan. So you form a plan. Put it on paper if you have to. In fact, I would suggest put it somewhere. If you're above 50, put it on paper. If you're below 50, you don't use paper, so put it on something else. But make a plan. And then it's just a plan, right? A plan is only a plan if you don't do something with it. And the next part is action. Act on it. I want to order my steps according to your words. You got to move and start taking the steps and go, okay, I've met with God in a way that he's just begun to stir my heart, or he showed me something brand new. And there's been this divine disruption in my life, this beautiful thing that happened or a painful thing that happened. And then I formed a plan, like I sensed that out of this some greater good can come. And here's the next steps I want to take. Then you got to take them. And sometimes it's really hard to walk alone. I know that's true for me. There are times where I look at something and say, this one's going to take more than just me to do it. I need my brothers around me. I need my sisters around me. I need my friends. I need my family around me to walk this out with me, to take those next steps. But form an action plan and then begin to actually step into it. And the final one's my favorite on this. It's completion. I would tell you why it's. I love this one. It's because if you really want to see change, the anatomy of change in the life of a Christian, to see a true transformation in your life, this work actually isn't all yours to do. To the Philippian church, Paul wrote these words that he, Jesus, who began a good work in you, started something. It might have been in the worst of worst places that God stepped into the fire that you were in and began to rescue you. Or it may have been on a mountaintop where he met you. But he started to do, because he's good, and he started to do this good work in you, will bring it to completion. That's what Paul said. He's the one that started it, and he's the one that will bring it to completion, which means this, that our work is actually to let him do it. Our work is to just open up our hands and say, we receive your love. We receive your grace. We receive your invitation. We receive that you are the one that wants to restart my heart to beat in sync with yours. You are the one that is able to renew my mind. You are the one that is able to cause these legs of mine to begin to walk in a direction where I felt so worn out, I didn't know if I could walk anymore. You are the one that can invite me more into grace. You're the one that can begin to heal what feels like it is so broken. You're the one that can actually bring about transformation. You're the resurrection. You're not just somebody. You are the resurrection. You defeated the grave itself, which means I trust you to do that good work in me.